Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coyus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coyus Institute.
How are you settling in down there?
Oh, we feel very safe, very comfortable. We're slowly acclimating to the reduced oxygen.
Right, right.
That's one of the biggest problems. Well, close behind that is waking up to a temperature of 12 in the morning.
A little bit different to the Florida sunshine.
Well, yeah, when you're used to bundling up when it gets down to 60, well, there's a little train.
What do you think, Roke? Let's just jump into something that's kind of happening right now. What do you think about the whole Alaska, Canada, I think Montana as well, these unidentified objects that are apparently being disengaged? Because there's been so much coverage of the China balloon. We saw photos, we saw videos. This one's being kept very much under the lid. What do you think's going on?
Well, to be honest, as I've told you before, I'm a skeptic, a true skeptic. I don't have enough information yet. They haven't told us enough yet. They're retrieving the piece parts of these things they've shot down. I'd like to see that and see what they have to say about it. If they say anything, they may hide all that from us. I don't know. But I'm reserving judgment until I have enough data. At heart, I'm an experimentalist. I need data, and I don't have enough data yet.
I've heard a couple of little whispers that apparently because of the China balloon, NORAD had kind of adjusted and reconfigured its sensors. And basically because of that, they suddenly started picking up a bunch of unknown traffic in their airspace. And it's starting to freak leadership out a little bit.
They were probably setting their acquisition windows too high speed velocity. And so they weren't picking these things up. They weren't considered a problem because they're too slow. That makes me wonder if really they're all balloons that are just drifting, more or less drifting with some propulsion. But again, that's just, I wonder about those things.
Yeah.
But I just don't have enough information. They haven't told us enough. We haven't seen it yet.
That's kind of what's making me a little bit more suspicious, is because they gave us, a relatively satisfactory level of information about the balloon. And everyone could see that it was clearly a balloon, and this one's being kept. Well, not this one, multiple incidents are occurring. And, I've got my own family members who usually don't really show much interest in this subject messaging me going, "What's going on right now?" I'm like, "I have no idea. I haven't got any answers for you."
I think anybody who's being honest would have to say we have no idea yet. We don't have enough information. I saw a thing just today. I'm not sure how I got it. This guy is taking high-speed videos of aircraft and helos and things of that sort that get above 150 feet, and all of a sudden these very fast flyers fly around these devices.
Right.
Whether it's Marine One with the president on board, or a police helicopter or army helicopter, whatever. I guess he could spoof all those things. But again, he's got a lot of video.
Yeah.
That's
one of those ones that's kind of known in the UFO community. I think they're called typically fast walkers. And that's right. The term for these ones that seem to just zip by at incredible speeds, usually near other airplanes or, near helos and other objects. Yeah.
That's what we call them in the Navy, too. Fast walkers or fast movers. The helo appears in the video to be standing still because whatever this thing is, and it's the shape of the Tic Tacs, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. He could be spoofing that whole thing, or it could be real.
That's the difficult thing with the UFO subject in general, especially in the modern era when anything can be faked and photoshopped and edited. It's very difficult to ascertain. I mean, unless there's an official government stamp on it, and even then people are doubtful of what the government's really showing. So it's very difficult to gain clarity. Well, I mean, what do you think would probably be the best steps to try and actually gain some sort of objective evidence in terms of like scientific methodologies or ways in which you might approach the subject?
I'd like to see the debris that they retrieved from these shootdowns given to an open university somewhere or multiple universities. That would be better. Instead of just one, give it to two or three universities, have them study the artifacts and see what it is.
Yeah.
And then make sure that that's open to the public. We're well past our government considering us all as children who can't handle new information.
Well, speaking of trying to find the truth, you were recently contacted by someone within the government, within an interesting committee, and they were interested in the truth. They wanted to know what exactly you were finding out in the Advanced Theoretical Physics group, which we'll get into a little bit later on in terms of that group itself. But is there anything that you can speak on in regards to being contacted? Because I remember when we first did our first interview and I emailed you afterwards saying, hey, look, there's a chance that maybe this might generate some interest and people might get hold of you. And someone has. So, what exactly was the nature of the call?
Yeah, I was a little bit taken aback by that I had a call from Congress. It was congenial. He was very friendly. He obviously was interested in the ATP meetings. He must not have had the meeting notes in front of him because he didn't go through those notes in any kind of organized fashion. He asked me some salient questions, and I did my best to answer him. As you know, I answer only what I know to be fact or what I suspect strongly. And if I suspect something strongly, I try to imply that that's a suspicion. That's what I think. That's my theory. Do you have Linda's notes available?
Well, I made a little copy and wrote down some questions related to things. I mean, one of the things that struck me as quite interesting was their interest in, I think it was like 150,000 gauze magnetic field that seemed to be associated with UFO sightings. And I think they asked if there was a way to measure the signatures, and you gave an interesting response that involved a gadget developed by someone called Buchholz.
Yes, that was one of my disappointments from that meeting. Probably my biggest disappointment.
Really?
They put this gadget on the table in front of this off-tier group, and I thought that was really interesting, and they described what this thing did, that it would emit a signal whenever there was an unidentified flying object anywhere in the horizon. And so my experimental physics thinking got triggered, and I said, well, hey, let's outfit that thing. I'm in charge of a remote tech site, and we have plenty of territory, plenty of, as a matter of fact, you've got open sky up high on a mesa top. Let's outfit it with your gadget, and when it makes a signal, cause it to trigger a recording system and a 360-degree camera. We can rotate that camera 360 degrees and have it take video. And I described all this, and it went nowhere. And I thought, well, are they not interested in gathering real data?
Who are you describing it to? Who are you pitching this to? Like,
in the group. In general.
Huh.
Now, maybe I didn't express myself well enough, or I don't know, but it was never followed up on.
Theoretically, you think that would have been an ideal setup to kind of...
If that gadget was really emitting a signal whenever there was a UFO within sight, then why not video that? Leave it to the electronics. Don't put a human being in the middle of it. Have the electronics take care of videoing that thing. Then you have video evidence, and it's evidence that you haven't tampered with. I call that data. I call that something you can hang your hat on. something you could say, well, look at this, we've got something going on here.
So who was this Buchholz guy that had this gadget?
I had never met him before.
No. Did he have like an Intel or military inventor background, or
inventor? I think he was, you know, a garage inventor. I'm not sure. I hesitate to say what he was all about because I really don't know. and I didn't know him before, to my knowledge. Not sure who brought him to the meeting. I didn't. And I'm not sure I'm being fair with my assessment of what did not happen.
Right.
But in fact, I know that nothing happened. And I was disappointed with that.
Fair enough. And the person that called you was interested in remote viewing a little bit as well, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think of remote viewing?
Well, let's see. I know people who have been involved in that in private situations, personal situations, and research, real research funded by government agencies. And we know that's been going on because we've got evidence of that in the literature.
Yeah.
That there were those kind of programs. And I know that some reasonably useful data came out of some of those programs. But that's all I really know. I was not involved myself, so I can't speak to it as a participant.
About as a physicist, in terms of non-locality and quantum entanglements, information being exchanged across separations?
Well, I think it's entirely possible that remote viewing has validity. I don't see a problem with it. What the mechanism is, I don't know. But I have my own set of theories on such things, which I don't really want to get into right now because they're off the wall. But I believe
all of this is a bit off the wall, to be fair. But hey, look, you know, if you're not.
Yes, it is. Linda's whacking in the background.
Well, I certainly believe in the validity of remote viewing. I've had my own strange experiences, as you know, and that was tied intrinsically to me perturbing my consciousness and trying to get something to happen, and things happen. So I think there's a lot of validity to it. But yeah, they were interested in remote viewing. I mean, the thing is with the UFO subject, and I think as it becomes more relevant within the mainstream world and the scientific community start digging in even more, they're going to have to come to the realization that there is an integral component to it that is consciousness related, that is in some way related to the weird quantum, spooky, not, you know, non-local kind of behavior that we attribute to psychic phenomena. And it seems that there's a bridge between those two things, which I find interesting. And it's a steep, steep learning curve for people who are going to come into this and realize there's a much deeper trench to kind of get into.
Yeah, I agree. Well, you've heard me talk before about the fact that we are spiritual beings. We exist in a physical body, but our physical body and our senses in this physical body kind of overpower our senses in the spiritual world.
Yeah.
And so we don't really understand the spiritual world that well at all, as a matter of fact. And so there may be something there in those extra dimensions or in that spiritual world that we don't grasp yet. But some people have been able to touch on it, if you will.
Yeah. I think that there are people who have a certain level of sensitivity, just like anything else. You know, just like anything else, there are people who are born and they have a particular type of muscle that makes them a fantastic runner. And there are some people that are born, I think, with a layer of sensitivity to things that people don't normally see or feel or, you know, experience. We don't really know much about that. It's an undiscovered science, or it's a forgotten science. I think maybe a little further back in our history, we had a better idea around consciousness, but so far we haven't really figured it out.
Well, I've seen people witness to spiritual. Children, as an example, don't seem to be blocked off to it.
Right.
And so they seem to be able to sense the spirit.
Because they're so early through the doors. They're so early in. They haven't had time to absorb all of the other stuff.
They haven't had time to build up protections against it or whatever. My wife's mother, we were visiting her in hospice, and she was very near death. And she couldn't even talk. She just could mumble or say a single syllable every now and then. And she was looking at the upper right corner of the room and moving her eyes back and forth. And finally, Linda said, "Mom, are you seeing the angels?" And she nodded. She said, "Yes, I'm seeing the angels." And I believe she was. I believe that she was very near death. And she was a Christian woman. She was she was seeing the spiritual world.
Yeah.
And I was going somewhere when I died. And luckily it didn't appear to be a hot place and it wasn't down. But the lady who was praying for me rescued me each time before I got to the corner of that room.
Yeah.
So I never really saw the whole result.
Well, there's plenty of evidence for this. There's plenty of compelling testimonies of this type of thing. I don't know if you've ever heard of... Have you heard of a guy called Eben Alexander? He was a neurosurgeon.
No, I haven't.
You should look into that story. It's such an amazing story because he was very much, a materialist, skeptic, scientist, didn't really have a belief in the afterlife or anything like that. And he contracted a very rare form of meningitis, and it just shut his whole body down. He was, he literally did die on the operating table. And his experience changed his life. He came back. He had a near-death experience. It was extremely vivid, and it even had a component of him meeting someone in that space who he'd never met before, who he then encountered in life later on. And so there was this very strange kind of space-time component of having an experience related to it in his waking life afterwards. And Eben Alexander, E-B-E-N, Alexander, very, very intelligent man and just describes his experience with a lot of detail. And I think he sounds very sincere to me.
We'll look him up.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's captured that name.
Yeah. No, I highly recommend it. So, another thing that was brought up, and this is one of those really interesting stories that I've been fascinated by, and I don't know if there's enough information out there, and other people are very curious about it, and it's the Philadelphia experiment that was brought briefly. Can you explain to people, at least to your knowledge, what the Philadelphia experiment was meant to be and what you maybe think it actually was?
All right. First of all, I haven't read nearly all the stuff that is out there on the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah,
I have seen the things about making people and making ships disappear and all of that thing. I find that highly improbable that was what was going on. As a matter of fact, I know at that time, one of the things the Navy was interested in was making ships invisible to magnetic mines, not invisible to the eye. And so they were wrapping electrical coils around various parts of ships. And energizing those to reduce the magnetic signature of the ship so that a ship wouldn't set off a magnetic mine. I know that to be the case because the ships I was on had Helmholtz coils that we had to periodically test. There were ranges that we would have to go through that would test whether or not our magnetic signature was reduced appropriately. And so I believe that what they're looking at there is testing of reducing or making invisible the magnetic signature of ships so it wouldn't set off the mine. It's as simple as that. The rest of it's sensational.
Yeah, where did the story come from? Where did it come from?
Well, because in a sense they are making the ship invisible, but it's invisible to the magnetic mind, not invisible to the human eye. And so I think that's where it was. Now this is supposition on my part, but in looking at the field of all this advanced stuff, whether it's UFOs, UAPs, or remote viewing, there are people out there that will latch on to any term and carry that to the far extreme and tell what I call goosebumply stories, you know. I'm not a big fan of goosebumply stories. I mean, if you're sitting around a campfire eating s'mores, yeah, okay, that's fine. that's fun. But, you know, in a field that requires serious investigation, which I believe the UAP field does, it's not helpful to do those kind of things. That's where I stand on that. I think they just took the invisibility comment and ran with that and became sensational with it.
Have you heard of, because he's mentioned in the Admiral Wilson documents, Bob Beckwith?
I know of him. I don't know him.
Yeah, because he actually wrote a paper about, well, not just about the Philadelphia experiment. It was a paper about time travel and teleportation and different high energy experiments that might yield those kind of results. And within that, he actually talks about the Philadelphia experiment. So I was kind of surprised to see someone like Bob Beckwith talking about it. And he was talking about it in the way of it was, you know, a legitimate experiment gone wrong that caused horrendous incidents on board,
trapped in
different parts of the ship and all of this. And I don't know why. I mean, why do you think he'd be so adamant about it?
I don't know. Maybe he's got more information than I do. I won't say that he's wrong, but it sounds sensational to me, and especially when I know what the Navy was in fact interested in that at that time. But it would be handy to make a ship invisible to the naked eye, but I don't believe that especially in the Philadelphia yard where they do serious ship repair work and things of that sort, I don't think they were doing that.
Fair enough. One thing that they wanted to talk to you about, or at least it was discussed, the gentleman by the name of Ed Speakman, who was the chief scientist on General Stubblebine's staff at Army Intelligence. In the notes he provided, it said that Ed Speakman asked, "Are we being led to conclude that an organization exists that sucks up all this material into a box?" To which a gentleman by the name of Robbie responds by saying, "I think you can believe that." So could you expand on this conversation at all? And who's Robbie?
Well, first of all, you touched on two names that are very interesting to me because they're very interesting characters, both of them, for different reasons. Ed Speakman was fascinating. He was the chief scientist in Army Intel. He worked on General Stubblebine's staff as chief scientist. And I met him with John Alexander, I might add, at Army Intel, and we were on a totally different topic. And he told me the story of the invention of the telescoping antenna for automobiles. I don't know if I told you that before. When he was a fresh-caught EE graduate, he went to work for Philips Radio. I think it was Philips. And he no sooner got on board the corporation than I said, "Get your butt up to Detroit and you solve the radio antenna problem and don't you come home until you've got it solved." And so he spent a couple months up there and he came up with the idea of the telescoping antenna. What they were doing before was they were running wires in the overhead of the car, and in the tops of the car were fabric. Canvas, and so the canvas would vibrate and break the wires, and so the antenna would quit working. Well, he came up with the idea of the telescoping antenna. Came back home, they're a big hero. They paid him $1 for the invention. as he was proud of that, he got his dollar, and he was the guy that invented that idea. So that's why so for that reason, I knew Speakman, I knew of him, I'd had that chat with him, and so I paid close attention to what he had to say. Well, Robbie, on the other hand, was Ron Blackburn's office mate at DOE Albuquerque. And Willie Williams and I, when you were both working at the laboratory in Los Alamos, would come down to DOE headquarters once a month and visit with Ron, and Robbie was off to the side of Ron. Ron was in the dinner desk, and obviously Robbie was supposedly his civilian counterpart or whatever. And he always struck me as a bit of an odd character. I couldn't place what he was really all about. And bottom line is, I finally decided that he was the real spook in the room. That Ron Blackburn, as odd as he seemed, and he was odd, he was very smart, very intelligent, a real blast to talk to. We had fun every time we went down there. But Ron Blackburn was very outspoken and very, very interesting, let's put it that way. Well, Robbie would just sit over in to the side, and as we were discussing some whiz-bang idea or whatever, he would make some pithy remark. And I always thought, you know, that guy knows more than he's telling us. I just got that impression, because this went on for well over a year while Ron was there. Sometime after this meeting at ATP, Robbie died. And I was told that he died under suspicious circumstances. But I don't know. He was a very interesting character, very intelligent. Again, the two of them in that room, I think Willie and I, well, at least I, lowered the average IQ when I walked in the room. Willie probably raised it, surely raised it. But so that's who Robbie is. And his comment that you may be able to, how'd it go?
Let me just get it back up. Ed Spiegman said, are we being led to conclude that an organization exists that sucks up all of this material into a box? And then Robbie says, I think you can believe that.
That is quintessential Robbie. That's the kind of pithy remark that he made about a lot of things that we discussed with Ron Blackburn when we came down to our monthly meeting.
Well, I mean, the DOE is high up on the list. How do you feel about their involvement?
Well, I spent a lot of years in the Navy, so yeah. I grew up as a shaved tail ensign, thinking that the DOD was the most hidebound organization imaginable, until I worked for the DOE. They are even worse. They are in charge of, ostensibly, the national laboratories. At least at that time, the national laboratories I consider to be an absolute national treasure, because your typical Lockheed Martin or whomever corporate company that's dealing in advanced technology and things of that sort, they can't really investigate what I call the bleeding edge of technology. The national laboratories had that broad base of scientists and a deep pool of scientists, of very intelligent people, and they could do that kind of thing because that's what they really were designed for. They were really designed. Matter of fact, I always thought that if a national laboratory, other than the nuclear realm, of course, but if the other scientists in the national laboratory weren't doing experiments that failed at least 50% of the time, they weren't doing the right experiments. We should have been failing about half the time, because we should have been out there on the bleeding edge, not the leading edge, the bleeding edge of technology, you know, where nobody's gone before, and the country needs that. Whether they're doing that now or not, I really don't know. I'm out of touch with that. And they may be. I hope they are.
Do you think DOE probably has some of these programs, these retrieval and reverse engineering programs?
Not DOE itself, but the laboratory.
Yeah, it's stovepipe subsidiary.
Laboratory. Yeah, laboratory.
Labs, yeah.
I think it's quite possible.
Los Alamos?
Yeah.
But you never got a...
Have you ever seen Los Alamos? You ever seen a map of Los Alamos?
No.
It sits on Finger Mesas, about I think it's five or seven Finger Mesas from an extinct volcano. And I forget how many square miles it is, but it's a huge laboratory, huge in the sense of territory that it covers. For the special project, our special technologies program that I ran, we were out at one of the remote sites. We basically own a mesa top, and you can hide almost anything out there. As a matter of fact, for a while, we used to make fun of the fact that the UFO community thought that my site was hiding the crashed UFOs. And so we've developed these fake badges for our technician scientists that said, admit nothing, deny everything, make counterclaims.
I'd love to get
a little alien face on the front.
I'd love to get my hands on one of those badges.
Yeah, the director of the laboratory wanted one also. Linda designed another. What did yours say? What's that? Oh, okay. She says her said the same thing. She worked in the director's office. So
yeah. That's funny.
If you I don't know if you still can do it, but if you Google TA-33, you may find that those folks hide all the craft alien craft or the bodies of the alien.
TA-33. Now, the only thing I'm getting is a type of assault rifle that I think goes by the same name. So,
well, they may have dropped that story.
Yeah.
Maybe we poked fun at it enough that they quit.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, a little too much. Does Los Alamos go like deep subterranean? Is there a lot of levels?
There are some levels. I never got deeply into those levels. But my goodness, there's so many mesa tops and cannons. Yeah. You can hide almost anything there.
Mm.
And they did. If we were doing, as an example, if we were doing an explosive experiment of some sort, you can't avoid the explosion making a pattern on the dirt around on the area around exploding, and that pattern can give away information, especially if we're trying to design a specific thing. The people who are conducting those experiments would keep close tabs on the satellite systems so that there were no satellites within range or with anywhere in the ability to be able to see that pattern on the mesa or on the canyon, actually. They were done down in canyons, so that you had to be almost directly overhead to get the information. I wouldn't discount anything, but I can't confirm anything because I haven't seen it with my own eyes.
Nobody gave you a little wink and said, oh yeah, we've got the sources down here. No. So let's jump a little bit into the Advanced Theoretical Physics group. So for anyone who hasn't heard of this group before, could you maybe explain what the group was, how it got started, who was involved?
Well, I believe that it was pulled together by John Alexander, General Stubblebine, who had gone to, what was the name of the company? Who had gone to a company there where we conducted the meetings. And the chief scientist, Speakman, I think they are the ones that pulled it together. And basically they pulled together people around the government who had top secret clearances and were working in fields that might impact on the UFO environment. I had a casual observer's interest in the UFO area. I couldn't get involved in it, as I've said before. But I had a couple of my scientists who were deeply involved in it, in a personal level. And John was one of them. So I believe they pulled it together. And the purpose was to gather these people together, basically a think tank, if you will, to try to come up with a way of approaching government agencies to try to attract funding to actually conduct experiments. My little experiment with the gadget wouldn't have cost anything. I could have pulled that together from piece parts in the various labs that were in my building. Wouldn't cost us anything, essentially. But that was the idea, and that fell on that went over like a lead balloon, as they say. We didn't get anywhere with that.
Yeah, when did you get involved with the group?
Oh, right away. I was at the first meeting, and there was a follow up meeting several months later. The first meeting, the notes say that. As a matter of fact, at one point, I thought the notes were not chronological, but I realized that the notes are from two different meetings.
Right.
And by the way, those notes, anybody who looks at those things and gets goosebumps. Yeah, keep in mind that I was quite adept at taking notes on highly sensitive topics in a way that would not divulge the sensitive information. What I would do...
Are you trying to say that there's some hidden keys to be found within those notes?
There may be. But I briefed all around the country... almost on a monthly basis. And back in those days, you had to carry plastic viewgraphs. You didn't have the handy laptop or something like that, or a thumb drive that you could take along to plug in and show your viewgraphs. And so I would, in order to not have to lift weights in order to get ready for my trip, I would create my viewgraphs with bullet points that would just remind me I need to talk about this topic. Okay, I need to talk about that topic, and how about this? And those slides weren't classified, but I wouldn't want them at the public because then someone might be able to piece it together. So these notes don't divulge anything that I would consider sensitive. It was just to remind me these are the topics that people talked about. I might also say if there are pages in there where I put a header on the top of the page and then there's nothing on the page, that meant that I was supremely bored with that.
Supremely bored, yeah. I know how that felt when I was going through university with my notepad and there would just be an empty sheet and blah, blah, blah. I was interested in that lecture, was I?
And that person said nothing of interest to me. So...
Well, I think one that was obviously of interest to you was Admiral Bobby Ray Inman being circled as a potential manager of reverse engineering programs. Now, you know I've spoken to him, had him on the record. He denied any sort of involvement, but we do know that Bob Exler, the NASA mission specialist, got him on the record saying that there were vehicles that were being studied and he wasn't sure if it would ever be released. And I mean, this guy ran five different intelligence agencies, was on the Director of Science Applications International Corporation. So, yeah, I think it's pretty likely. But why was he circled around? That kind of indicates a level of importance, surely.
Well, of course, that was a very interesting comment that was made. And Bobby Inman was someone who was already of interest to me. At one time, I considered taking a job down to Texas and applying for a job because I'd heard that, in some sense at least, he was preferentially hiring Naval Academy grads. That was interesting to me. But I had other research that I was hesitant to break myself away from those things. I figured they'd just fall on the mesa tops and not be done by anyone if I left. So I didn't follow up on that. So Bobby Ray Inman's name, first of all, caught my attention. And then, of course, the fact that he said that they had reverse engineering going on, that interested me quite a bit.
Can you say who brought up his name in the meetings?
I don't recall. I don't really recall. And nothing evidently was said to make me believe they had hard evidence of that.
Right, because you took no additional notes.
Right. So it was really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I would have taken notes if something more, you know, something to support that interest was mentioned, and it was evident.
So was anything ever kind of discovered by the ATP group that you haven't been able to disclose publicly because of the sensitivity of what was discovered? Any information that was provided to you guys?
I wouldn't say we discovered anything.
No.
That was never...
That's what Jack Sarfati says as well. You know Jack Sarfati?
I know the name, of course, but I don't know him that well.
No, not that well. Yeah, well, he said a similar thing, but so nothing was really discovered internally.
No, that was another disappointment to me. I'm not, as I've told you before, I'm not a fan of standing around or sitting around the campfire and swapping stories that you can't back up with data. And that's basically what we did. I was disappointed in that. I thought maybe I was being naive, but because I didn't have anything that I could share that I could back up with data, I wanted to pursue that gadget that Buchholz mentioned.
Right.
But no one presented hard evidence of any type. And so, in a sense, all we really were doing was a bunch of highly placed individuals who were doing research in interesting areas. And we were just telling stories.
Yeah.
Dick Stewart, by the way, is another interesting name to me. Who
was that, sorry?
Jake Stewart,
okay.
He didn't say much. He said a little bit in that meeting, but he was even harder over than I am about, you know, well, where's the information? Where's the data? He was the chief of naval operations, the head of the chief naval operations scientific panel. They call it the executive panel. And I briefed him on Willie's theory, the dynamic theory. And he was really, really interested in that. Took my view graph of the expanded Maxwell equation. And then he was asked to come over to the White House and buff up the speech for the Star Wars speech for Reagan. That was an interesting thing. Ed Teller was a brilliant scientist, of course, but he was terrible at speech writing. So he wrote the original speech for President Reagan, and it was terrible, which they expected. And Jake Stewart and a couple other people were asked to come over and buff it up, and so that's what he did. I know that something's going on, whether it's advanced vehicles that we have designed or others have designed, or extra dimensional devices. I don't know. I know from experience that Los Alamos was used to fly experimental aircraft overhead, and try to sense what they could sense from that. Matter of fact, we saw the stealth fighters before the stealth fighters became known to the public. And they flew over the laboratory several times. And I'm sure what they were doing there was they were trying to see, well, okay, there's stealth in that regard, but what other signatures are apparent from these devices? How could people see these without radar or without seeing them visually or whatever? And I know those kind of things were done because Los Alamos, at least at that time, was a no-fly zone. It's possible that whatever we saw in our hot tub that night was an advanced craft of some sort. It's also possible that it was an interdimensional creature or an interdimensional device. I don't know.
Had a very weird appearance to it, this one specifically, didn't it?
It did. It was the shape of, I've been saying, a stingray, you know, a ray that you would see in the ocean, not the car. it had a raised, it's not really a fuselage, just an indistinct raised spine down the middle, and it had glowing circular orbs around the other side. It appeared that, because it went directly over our head, it appeared we were looking through some kind of field because it was shimmering what somewhat. And that may have been why we got the sense that it was almost flapping wing, but not really flapping wings. It was just kind of moving. Scared the dickens out of our dog, because the dog left Linda, which was not a thing it ever did, and went inside. The only other time that happened, when there was a coyote out there roaming around. So the dog said something. I don't know what that was. I just know that because I was making so much fun of my sons, that they then, from that point on, have riddled me about that. Got you on that.
But I remember. Yeah, well, I bet you're glad you looked up and actually saw it for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows? I guess something so strange could have been developed by us. I probably lean a little bit more towards another explanation, but I mean, I think about the comments made by people like Ben Rich from Lockheed Martin Skunk Works and some of the kind of statements he was supposed to have made over time. And I do think that we've managed to get something going, electrogravitic field propulsion.
I'm hopeful too.
Yeah, I do think we've managed to get something going.
That's a suspicion. As I've told you before, I suspect, and Willie and I both suspected this before he passed on, that the government had taken his theory and produced some devices out of that, because that theory, that five-dimensional physics theory, and the expanded Maxwell equations say that there is a connection, there is a coupling between electromagnetism and gravitation. And now it's got to be weak, or it's got to be unique in some way, because we'd be levitating people off the floor with our electronic devices. So we know that's not it. We also know that, by the way, the potential for lasers existed in those original Maxwell equations in the 1850s, and they weren't developed until the 1960s, because people didn't see that. They couldn't make that connection. Well, that may be what we're seeing with those equations. We're just not clever enough yet, or at least I'm not, to see how you would go about producing an anti-gravitic device from those equations.
Well, it's funny, because that was literally, I don't know if we brought this up last time I spoke to you, but that's one of the quotes that Ben Rich apparently gave, was that there was an error in the equations, and that we figured out that error, we solved this problem. And even, I think it's either James Fox, the documentary maker, or Bryce Zabel, who's another Hollywood producer. And one of them was approached at a party by a guy who was supposedly a spook, who handed him a little equation and was basically saying, like, wink, wink, nod, nod, this was the secret sauce, so to speak. And, this quote from Ben Rich about there apparently being an error in the equations makes me wonder if they didn't figure that out.
Oh, could well have. We know from world-class mathematicians going through Willie's theory. And five-dimensional mathematics is not child's play.
Yeah.
It's very, very difficult.
I can barely even handle fractions, so I'm out of my depth.
It's difficult. And Willie was expert at it, of course, and he developed his theory. But it's entirely possible that they took that theory, or theories like that, and develop gadgets that could be anti-gravitation. And I suspect they have. They didn't need a couple of Hanyok naval officers sitting on top of a mesa involved, so they didn't involve us.
Didn't involve you. Yeah, well, I think a lot of people probably feel the same way. I think this is a very, very exclusive club that exists in deep little spiral within the labyrinth. And I wonder if Congress is actually going to be able to crack this open. I mean, there's interest from both sides of the political aisle, which is a really good sign. Obviously, in a very kind of politically divisive time right now in America, there's agreement that this is important, that we should focus on it. But it's so deeply entrenched, the secrecy, the disinformation, the decades of it. I mean, do you think they're going to be able to actually find satisfactory evidence and bring it forward and kind of blow the doors open?
Well, I hope so. I don't know whether they will be successful. They could be. And as a matter of fact, if we see the whole system clam up at some point, we can start suspecting that what happened was they ran up against the black program. Actually, the unacknowledged programs that will lie to Congress and even the president, unable to do anything or a bit basically told to shut up about it. Now, whether we'll have some of those senators and congressmen with enough cojones to actually step forward and say something anyway, I don't know. We'll see. It'll be interesting. There's a Confucius curse. You ever heard that?
He said, "May you live in interesting times."
And that was a curse. Yeah. We live in interesting times. These times are more interesting right now than any time in history.
Yeah. We are on, and for multiple reasons. I mean, UFOs aside, there's just so much happening, and you know, the rate of progression feels just like it's getting faster and faster. It's very hard to predict where we'll be in the next 5-10 years. Geopolitical instability. There's just so much.
Yeah, that's true. So the answer is I don't know whether they'll be successful. It'll be interesting to watch what happens. I don't suspect that they'll get in touch with me again because, as I've told you before, I believe I was a peripheral player. I, you know, was aware. I knew all these people, watched what some of them did, but I had other things to do. I had a day job.
How did you meet Admiral Wilson? Are you able to say that?
Lynn and I have been talking about that. I believe the first time I met him was in a place called Airy Cottage in Newport, Rhode Island. You ever heard of the Cowsill, the singing Cowsills?
I haven't.
No, not many people have. They weren't all that big, but they had a huge castle of a mansion on Millionaire's Row in Newport, Rhode Island. And they had a three-story servants' quarters just down the hill from the castle. And several of us came back from Vietnam and we had more money coming out, you know, just falling out of our pockets because we had a whole year of not being able to spend our money, our salaries. And so we rented this cottage, 7-bedroom cottage. And all of us were bachelors. And so we created a Friday evening party that our married classmates could go to. We were in what was called Destroyer School. Destroyer School, by the way, is not a school on how to destroy things. There's a type of ship in the Navy called a destroyer. At any rate, we're all in Destroyer School for like 6 months or something. And we knew good and well our married classmates would not be able to do anything unless they had something specific and a consistent weekly thing to go to. And so we set this thing up. Every Friday evening, we had a party at the Airy Cottage.
Oak Shannon, partying it up.
Not one of the finer moments of my time, but but let's just say that it became so popular that all the restaurants and bars in the local area were empty on Friday night. on average, we had 300 or so people in our house. And it was big enough to hold them. Yeah, it was huge. At that time, who became Admiral Wilson was at school just across from us. And I believe that's where I met him. I vaguely remember that.
So you're telling me that you met Admiral Wilson when you were partying it up in this 300 party mansion?
Oh, if you know, music and dancing and
things. Oh, that's
it was not a bacchanal. It was not. You know, it wasn't that kind of party. It was just your friendly party, and people came and went. We had very few rules. One was no dope of any description in the place, because that could have ended all of our careers, even if we weren't involved.
Right.
We nearly killed a guy one night because he was smoking a toke in the kitchen. we found him lighting up and ejected him from the temple. He never come back.
Ejected him from the premises.
That's right. That's right. So Airy Valleys became, and we're probably people out there who will view this video who will remember the term Airy Cottage.
Yeah. Giving them some nostalgia flashbacks to partying with you.
Yeah. I believe that from the best I can tell, that is where I first met him. But, you know, I've been involved in highly classified discussions in the Navy and at the laboratory for a lot of years. So,
with him?
And I briefed Chief of Naval Intelligence. I briefed Joint Staff. And, of course, below the Joint Staff, I briefed the President's what's that board called? The President's Scientific Board, whatever. I can't remember the name of it right now. Met Ollie North, by the way, in one of my briefings. That was interesting. We had a rear admiral and a couple of senior civilians in that briefing. And Ollie North came in a suit and sat down, and all those senior people deferred to him. I at the time, I was standing up in the front, and at the time I thought, well, that's really odd. Who's this guy? Well, it's Ollie North. And they deferred to him because his position was senior to theirs.
Well, look, Oak, I won't take up much more of your time. Like you said, you got a bit of a cough. And Linda, I hope you are. I know you can hear me in the background. I hope you feel better soon. Wishing you the very best. And thank you. It's been great, Oak. It's always good to catch up. And maybe at some point we can come and see you out in your new home.
I hope so. We've not had a whole lot of luck finding a new permanent home yet. But we're very comfortable in Willie's widow's place. She's been very gracious to us, and we've known her for a lot of years, and she's a sweet lady. Anyway, you're welcome to visit anytime you wish.
Thank you. I had a helicopter flying very low, so I had myself on mute then because it was just going shaking through the whole house. But yeah, appreciate that. Would love to come and see you guys, as you know. And thank you for having a conversation with me and opening up about the physics group. I think people are very interested to learn a little bit more about that. Especially good to know that people have been reaching out on their own to try and get more information. People in different committees and different parts of the Senate. It's promising. And as we said, we'll just have to see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. We live in interesting times, and let's just see where it all unravels and where it leads.